When you have a brand that tells a story or has layers to it, what happens is that it sort of arrests you and it makes you think about or engage with that brand even more. So you'll end up picking up the bottle. Once you've picked up the bottle, the likelihood of you buying that bottle is increased significantly.
Welcome to Drinks Insider, the podcast that's interested in everything you can drink. If it's legal, if you can sell it, and more importantly, if you can make money from it, then we're going to talk about it. So come on this journey into the commercial world of everything drinkable. I'm your host, Felicity Carter, and you're listening to Drinks Insider. Today on Drinks Insider, I want to introduce you to one of the most talented drinks packaging designers in the world. Rowenica Lewis is the woman behind some of the most iconic designs in the drinks space. She's worked on brands like Penfolds and 19 Crimes, and she recently created the labels for Dolly Wines, the first wines released by legend Dolly Parton. She's the co-founder, with Margaret Nolan, of Denomination, a brand agency headquartered in Sydney that's got offices in San Francisco and London. In this conversation, Rowena covers everything from current trends to collaborations with fashion designers. And don't forget, if you want a summary of the insights and takeaways, sign up for the Drinks Insider newsletter, which condenses everything into one short email. You can sign up at drinksinsider.com.
Rowena, it's lovely to see you.
And lovely to see you, Felicity.
So you are one of the top design and packaging experts in the world. Now, you work with wine. Do you work with spirits as well?
Yes, we work across the full spectrum of drinks. So from wine, spirits, beer, cider, RTDs, and increasingly the sort of no alk or alk removed part of the drinks category as well.
Oh, interesting. All right. I definitely want to talk to you about that later on. I'll start with some simple questions. So your background was originally in advertising and publishing. What did you learn from that you brought to design?
I think the thing that is the sort of constant that I learned was the power of storytelling. So with my first job at Random House, working with publishers, with the authors, I should say, and publishing their books and doing those publicity tours, and then into advertising where we were really looking at how to tell the story of the brand, bringing both of those aspects into design has really sort of transformed the way that I think of brands and why storytelling is a really important part of what we do at Denomination and certainly how I talk about branding.
Yeah, I first heard people start to talk about storytelling about maybe 12 years ago, and it just caught fire, this idea that everybody should tell their story. Do you think people still talk about it as much? Now I sort of hear the word authenticity replacing storytelling a little bit.
Well, I think there are two things. I think authenticity is incredibly important, and it's certainly something that the younger generations, Gen Z and millennials, really do look for. In terms of storytelling, I think that's different because I think storytelling is a way to create that emotional connection with a consumer. And once you create that emotional connection, all sorts of other wonderful things happen in your brain in terms of recall and memorability and attachment to a brand. So I think storytelling can really take your brand down a path where consumers can fall in love with it, whereas authenticity is like something that is a quality factor that you can tick off. It's a hygiene factor, I would say.
Now, your first ever wine client was Penfolds, of course, which has an extremely strong story. But let's talk about what was it about working on that made you decide to specialise in this area?
Yeah, well, I grew up on a farm. So my dad is a farmer, and so agriculture was part of my childhood. And not that I was a particularly good farmer, but I loved the agricultural side of the business. And then I think combined with wine, which is all about luxury and kind of fashion, if you like, which is also two of my passions, plus the fact that wine had these these just incredibly delicious products. It was just like a match made in heaven. So I started working on Penfolds in my second day at my first design agency, and I continue to work on Penfolds. We've been lucky enough to work on Penfolds for more than 25 years, if you count my previous roles. And it's just been this wonderful journey that started with this beautiful brand and this beautiful product, made me fall in love with it. And it's certainly, you know, when you're in a design agency and you have the choice between working on wine or pet food or, you know, toilet paper, it's like, yeah, I'll go for the wine, thanks.
Were you a wine drinker at the time?
Yes, I was. Yeah, my parents raised us. Family dinners were incredibly important to how I was brought up. So wine was always part of that. Not particularly great wine, I would say, but certainly wine nonetheless.
That's really interesting, because the Australia that I grew up in, you know, didn't have that unless you were Italian. So you must have had very sophisticated parents.
I'm not sure. I think most of them came from a bag and box, but still we certainly had wine. And then when I went to university, it was interesting. That was a fairly big wine drinking culture as well. Tyrrells will probably hate me for saying.
Well, I remember drinking really oaky, buttery Chardonnay at university. Yeah. And I was at a tasting a couple of years ago, and they had a very commercial buttery Chardonnay on the table, and everybody was like, why did they serve us that? And I was like, oh, my God, it's taking me back to my university.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we drank long flat red on regular nights out.
Goodness. All right. So when you founded your agency, how was it different from other agencies and in the way that you approached design at the time?
Sure. So this was 22 years ago. And at the time, design agencies tended to specialize in disciplines. So you had an environmental agency or corporate identity or packaging. I had worked across all of those disciplines. But what I wanted to do was specialize in what I loved, and that was the alcohol category. So wine being, I guess, the most important part of that, given it's such a big industry in Australia. So what we did was specialize in an industry rather than specializing in a discipline. So we would do all of those disciplines, but within the context of drinks. I guess the other thing that was different at the time was the fact that we were two female founders and leaders. And I would love to say that that is no longer the case, but actually that is still a differentiator from between us and many other agencies globally, that unfortunately there still aren't the number of female-led and owned agencies in the world.
Why is that? Is it because it takes more capital to get started and women don't have access to the capital?
Oh, I think there's such a multiple number of issues. We could talk about this for an hour, Felicity. I think fundamentally starting your own business, you know, you normally need to have quite a few years under your belt in terms of your career progression to actually have the experience and expertise to run your own business. And that often falls at the same time as when you're having kids. Or you've had kids and then you're sort of worried about how you're going to pay the mortgage. So I just think it falls into a really odd time in your career that just prevents you from taking that plunge. I think that's one of the things, and I think that, you know, I think that's probably the main, I mean, there are lots of others, but I think that's the main one that really comes to mind.
All right, let's get into the nitty-gritty of designing for the alcohol industry. Talk about the briefing process and what's the essence of a good brief, especially when sometimes you have clients that don't understand their own story or haven't articulated it very well.
Well, I think a brief is the most essential part of a project. You know, without it, I think the worst thing you can do is say, well, I don't really know what I want. I don't know where I want my brand to be. You just tell me. And for me, that's a really challenging thing to come up with, because, you know, you really don't have any boundaries, but you also don't have any opportunities or any challenges to really grab hold of. So, you know, some some marketers, like really, really good experienced marketers, can get to the essence of a brief really quickly and really succinctly. They're experts at it. But most of the time we're working with either marketers or wine owners who don't necessarily have that level of expertise. And so with that, we really do require a lot of information. So we will ask so many questions of the client to really get some of the sort of nuggets that come out of that conversation. Often the information that you gather during that briefing or interrogation sort of process really sparks the creative ideas that end up forming the brand.
Yeah, it's like writing your own CV or your own bio, isn't it? It's really hard to write about yourself.
So hard.
Think about yourself objectively. So yeah. You're not just an Australian agency. You've also opened offices in London and San Francisco. So can you tell me about what sort of sparked the idea to do that? And how do you know it's the right time to move into a new market?
Well, if only I knew the answer to this when we actually first started. I think for us it was about twofold. First of all, we realized when we opened the London office that there was an untapped opportunity in Europe, that actually there were lots of really good drinks agencies that did a lot of spirits, but potentially for wine, there wasn't really an agency, we felt, that had the experience with big global brands as well as small boutiques that could really, I guess, do both very well. So we felt that there was an opportunity there from that side of things. Plus, the UK in particular has an excellent creative university program. Mm. So designers tend to be extremely well trained in Europe and especially London. So we felt that we could actually get designers in London who would then also work for our Australian clients, albeit right. from the okay. London office. So what we did is just did, you know, a lot of research into the market, building a business case that we then obviously pressure tested with our board and made sure that, you know, we'd really assessed all of the opportunities, all of the risks before taking that plunge and opening up the London office in 2014. In 2018, we opened up another studio in San Francisco, and we did pretty much the same process, looking at the opportunities of that market and where we would sit in comparison to other competitor agencies out there. We're actually doing, I won't announce it now, but we're doing exactly the same process at the moment with the ambition to open up our fourth office. So you sort of go through. Come back to me in a few months for listening.
So I've worked for different companies internationally, and I found the cultural differences can be profound. Even working in the United States, you know, it's true that we're divided by a common language. The way of thinking about things, the design aesthetic is completely different. There are lots of different sort of cultural expectations. How did you adapt to working in sort of a different culture? I mean, even London can be quite different from Australia, though perhaps we're very comfortable with it.
Yeah, I think, to be fair, the Australian and British culture does seem to be probably a bit more connected than Australia and the US. What we do in terms of the design is that we really look at what are those cues that make a design feel like a quintessential Napa wine or a Washington State wine or an Italian or a French, or even when you get into France, the difference between a Rhone and a Burgundian wine. And you really analyze those design cues. And then what you want to do is you want to work out the ones that are essential to retain in order to make consumers feel as though this is a credible, authentic, in your words, brand, but that it's different, it's engaging, it's new, it's something that makes me feel something that the other brands out there don't. So it's really a matter of understanding how the nuances of design work and how they flex between all of those markets. The other thing that we tend to do is that, you know, when we're looking at global brands that have to transcend all of those markets, we're looking at ways where we can understand what the underlying consumer insight is. And that should transcend geographical boundaries. So, you know, sustainability, for example, is understood in relatively the same way, whether you're talking about UK, Australia, Africa, America, etc. So, you know, you really are trying to determine what that common thread is between all of those different regions in order to find a design that is actually going to be able to work effectively in all of those markets.
Well, how do you know when a packaging works? You know, what tells you that the design has worked versus when it doesn't work?
Well, the sales are a pretty good indication of that. So we keep a really close tab on how our designs are doing in the market. Luckily, most of them do extremely well. So that is gratifying. I think you build up this level of expertise where you can just tell when there is a winner within the options that you presented to a client. Sometimes that client won't choose that winner for whatever reason, but we certainly, if there's something that we know is going to be successful, we are certainly very clear in what we recommend as the design moving forward. And most of the time, you know, we're right just because we've had so many years of experience. I mean, I've been working in this industry for over 25 years, so that helps.
And how much do you use testing of different designs?
It really depends on the brand and the client. So with NPD or new product development, we don't tend to use testing as much if we think that it is so different that actually it's going to fail in consumer research because of the shock of the new. You know, it looks just so different when you're testing in an artificial environment like a research group or online, it just feels so different and polarizing. We find they are much better if we're sort of seeding them into on-premise and sort of high-end venues, and then you get this trickle-down effect into the big national accounts. That works better than testing it in qualitative research or quant. However, if it is a big brand and we're moving on and we've got millions of cases and we've got lots of stakeholders, including, you know, customers all around the world, having research data to back up the design change, both qual and quant, is incredibly useful in terms of sort of guiding the design. We might sort of change things depending on what comes out of research, but also justifying why that change is required and why it will work in market.
All right, so let's talk about the nitty-gritty of packaging. So what's the distinction between design that's just aesthetically pleasing and design that's communicating the brand or the story?
Well, I think that goes into the engagement that you get. So when something is pretty and it looks nice, it's really easy to see it and it, you know, it's pleasurable to look at, but it's not very easy to remember or engage with. When you have a brand that tells a story or has layers to it, what happens is that it sort of arrests you and it makes you think about or engage with that brand even more. So you'll end up picking up the bottle. Once you've picked up the bottle, the likelihood of you buying that bottle is increased significantly. Okay. But in order to pick up the bottle and then engage with it, you know, turn around the back label, read what's on the front label, take a second glance at it, etc., that all goes into your memory structure and starts to build this this recall of the brand that's actually in your hand. What then happens is once you've done that, is that when you see it again, you automatically get this feeling of trust because you've seen it before and it feels familiar. And that trust in a category that is just completely overwhelming for most consumers is a really important characteristic to have with your brand, or relationship to have between your brand and the consumer.
Okay, so let's talk about the product in very specific environments. So on the on-premise, for example, which might be dark and at night, and the bottle may be thrown into a well where the server is picking it up by touch, how do you design for that environment?
That's a hard one to design for. I think proprietary bottles play a really big part in that. Something that spirits have done incredibly well. You know, you can feel a bottle, you can feel a bottle of Johnnie Walker and you know that it's Johnnie Walker. Rosés have also done a great job. We probably haven't done a very good job across the rest of the category in terms of differentiating bottles. But certainly if you look at bottles like Paddington Lane that we've just done, or Penfold, which will have the crest, just having that actual physical touch is really important. Capsules also play a really big role. And I think lots of designers forget the role that capsules can play. So if you look at a brand like Tread Softly, where the front label is incredibly minimal, but the capsule has this absolutely beautiful, full-coloured illustration, like it's an oil painting of flora and fauna, and it's just stunning. And as soon as you see that capsule, you recognise the brand because it's so different. So I think just thinking outside of the label to all of the other elements of the packaging is really key to that.
And how different do you need to think through on-trade versus off-trade? And can you give me examples of things that might work in either of those environments that wouldn't work in the other, and things that do work?
Yeah, so I think for the on-trade, especially for restaurants, naming is really key. You know, you've only got a short space on a wine list and you need to communicate quite a lot. So you need to work out, well, what is it my brand needs to do compared to the other brands on that wine list? Does it need to spark engagement or interest or project the credentials? Whatever it is, whatever is right for that brand, you really need to think about how it sits in the context of that wine list. Oh, naming is such an art, right? It's such an art, and I think it's, again, something that people don't necessarily think of when they're thinking of those nuances.
I've interviewed so many sommeliers whose advice is, when you're faced with a wine list, is choose the most unpronounceable wine, because they say it's so difficult to sell that if somebody put it on the wine list, they must have really, really loved it. So it's going to be a good one.
Sorry,
I interrupted you.
So I would actually say the opposite to that, because I think consumers get really embarrassed when they can't pronounce a name and they don't know what it means, or they don't know how to pronounce it. And often they'll just skip it because they don't want to be embarrassed in front of their peers or loved ones at a table. So I would say that giving something that is easy to pronounce and that is not going to embarrass them in front of the expert, i.e. the sommelier, is actually really important. So I think the sommelier is doing it from their angle, but I would, I'm not sure that that's how I would go about that.
All right, so that's the naming. And what about the labels?
I think, in an on-premise environment, being able to sometimes having a label that looks really interesting from across the table, so that you're looking across the restaurant and something looks really interesting that might spark your attention. I think that's really interesting. I also think format is an interesting one. I know Graham's do a really big format port. I can't remember how many litres is it. Let's just say, 3 or 5 litres, but it's enormous. And so to actually pour it, it requires two people to one to hold the top of it and the other one to actually pour, because it's so big. But the theatre of that is absolutely fantastic. And they've actually designed the idea and and the pack around the theatre of pouring in an on-prem environment. That would never fly in off-premise. So just kind of things like that.
So when you're designing for the on-premise, do you actually stand in rooms and put bottles at different distances so you can see how they look across the room? I mean, how do you test your own work?
Well, we do a lot of mock-ups in here, so we don't necessarily go to restaurants, but all of the designs, part of our process is to actually do physical 3D mock-ups. So, whilst designers, especially in this day and age, love to look at designs on screen, they completely change when they're actually on a bottle. So that the size seems to change, all of the typography, the way that the colours work when they work against a dark bottle and the light that comes onto a bottle. So we're very insistent as part of our process that all of the designs are mocked up on bottles. So you can imagine our studio, it is absolutely full of bottles, but they sit out on everyone's desks and on meeting rooms and so forth. And so people are always coming by and commenting, and you can kind of just see the ones that are really resonating and the ones that you're able to see as you're coming down the hallway from a distance as well.
Do you have to think differently about design for spirits if you know it's going to be on a full-size bottle and also there'll have to be a miniature of it?
Yes, although we do try and get consistency between all of those different size formats, because whilst the bottle might be different, it's really important to have a label that actually works so that you can recognise something that's on a 500 mil and something that's on a 1 litre, that they're part of the same family. What you do have to do, though, is do sort of minor developments or sort of refinements on the label to make sure that when they're actually on that particular bottle, that they really kind of suit that bottle. So it's not just this is a 50% larger label. You really have to modify the elements within it to make sure that they feel right for that smaller format versus the larger format, but that overall there's a consistent approach.
Yeah, when you're talking about looking at design on screen, it just reminded me that in publishing, cover design has completely changed because now you have to have the design sitting in a little tiny white space on Amazon rather than in a bookstore, so that's okay. So let's talk about other design things. So a lot of bottles are going to sit in ice buckets. How do you make sure that the label doesn't float away?
Yeah, the label companies have done an enormous amount of work on this in the past couple of decades, where they've really been looking at liners of stocks and also varnishes to make sure that they are water or moisture repellent. To be honest, the only way that you can really make sure that the label is completely moisture repellent is to use plastic. It is something that we as a business have a pretty clear stance on. It's something that we don't recommend as much as we can. There are actually other alternatives to that that use, say, gum residue from trees that UPM put out. But essentially, plastic is the only thing that's going to repel the water. So what we're trying to do is we're getting, if we know that that a label, part of the range is either sparkling or white wine, we're going to specify a paper stock that has a real degree of moisture repellent for it. We'll also do things like we'll look at all of the embellishments to make sure that there's no lift on the edges of the label. So we try and leave like a 4 millimeter border at the end where you've got like a grain emboss, like an embossed texture, and that we just feather that off to the side so that actually when that label is adhered to the bottle, you've got this area of glue that's completely attached to the label.
All of this work on labels, does this mean that, labels will actually last in the cellar for a lot longer than they did in the past?
Yeah, I would imagine so. Yeah, because the adhesion is certainly stronger than what it used to be in the past. I mean, we've been using pressure sensitive labels now for probably about 30 years. prior to that, we used to use wet glue, which were those really old, very thin labels that literally went on like in a cartridge straight onto the bottle, a bit like beer labels. Some of those mass market beer labels are still on wet glue, and of course they just come off easily.
Okay, let's talk about trends. When I first started drinking wine back in the late 90s, there were coloured bottles everywhere. There were blue bottles, and I remember the precursor to Treasury brought out a green bottle, and there was a bottle, and everyone used them as candlesticks. And then coloured bottles disappeared. Why no coloured bottles?
Oh, this is so funny, Felicity. I actually worked on those bottles.
Did you?
Yes, I did. Really well. So, yeah, the green one was called Soho, and I can't remember what the pink one was called. they were, for the time, there was a big trend in coloured bottles. There was blue bottles that we used. They were kind of, I guess, taking inspiration from the water segment that was starting to use really innovative colours with their glass for water. And we looked at that within the wine category. I think, I mean, they certainly worked at the time, but they were very sort of fashion led. And I think what it comes down to is that with successful wine branding, you've got to be able to balance the rules. You've got to be able to break some rules and keep other rules. And coloured bottles seem to be a rule that that when you do them, they just make everything within the bottle so disruptive that it reduces the level of credibility or authenticity.
Even water bottles now, I don't see those coloured water bottles either. They tend to be clear or blue.
Yeah. There is also a sustainability question about those coloured bottles as well, because they require another. So it's either going to be have a plastic sleeve, which obviously everyone is moving away from, or they have to go through another process where they're actually coated with a paint essentially on the bottle, and they have to be fired. So that's additional energy. So I think from that point of view, people are moving away from them as well.
I wonder if any of those bottles are still in people's cupboards, because at one point anyone who was in a share house had candles stuck in those bottles.
Yeah. Those bottles were there. I remember them well.
Yeah. Okay, so what sort of elements do you take into consideration when you're designing for different markets? So, for example, we talked about how the US is quite a different market. So how do you think differently for the US, and and here's a difficult question, how do you do it when it's going to go into one big market like the US, but it also is going to go into export markets? How do you satisfy all the different cultural nuances?
Yeah. So if you want a brand that feels quintessentially from California, I'm going to use Napa because that's obviously a region that everyone knows very well. There are certain characteristics of Napa labels that you don't actually find in many other labels around the world. The way that they use script typefaces, the way that the sort of typographical choices that they make, they all are in a sort of similar genre. So when we're looking at a US label, we're making sure, back to my earlier point about breaking some rules and not others, integrating some of those characteristics of a quintessential Napa label, but also making them different. So you don't want to just be the same. You want to have similarities, but also be different and be better. So that's how we try and make that work. In terms of the global application, it kind of goes deeper than just the packaging look and feel. It's about identifying what is about that brand that is actually going to resonate with all sorts of different consumers. So if I take 19 Crimes with Snoop Dogg, so say Cali Gold, what we're looking at is we're going down into the sort of consumer psyche about why consumers would be attracted to 19 Crimes. And it's about them sort of breaking boundaries, but within a sort of safe environment. So that idea of breaking boundaries is a common theme, whether you're, you know, a 25-year-old living in London or, you know, a 30-year-old living in Sydney or living in the US, it's the same idea, the same insight applies to all of those different consumers. So once you identify that, that leads on to how you execute it. But consumers are actually buying into that, into a brand that is representing something that they may not have even sort of conceptualized in their head, but it's speaking to them at a much deeper level.
That's such an interesting example because back in, I think it was 2016 when it first came out, I actually spent some time in J. Walter Thompson advertising agency in London hearing the strategy that they'd done. And the strategy was so well thought through about the boundary breaking and being a bit cheeky and stuff like that. And you know, so many people tried to copy their augmented reality labels, but they just did it as a gimmick without understanding that there was a whole strategy and a whole story behind it. It wasn't just for its own sake. It was part of something that was, you know, really well thought through.
Yeah, definitely. The AR side of 19 Crimes is exceptional. You know, it's a game changer.
So when is it time for a packaging design refresh?
It sort of depends on lots of different things. I think it's going to depend on what your sales are doing. You know, are your sales stagnating or are they declining? What your brand health metrics are. You know, are you seen as being old fashioned? Like, you know, where you want to be and versus where consumers see you, is there a difference there between the two? And you know, are there things that have happened in the market that you really need to adapt your brand to? So say, you know, glass weight, for example. 10 years ago, we weren't even interested in glass weight. Today, we're very interested in glass weight. So that's a great example of having to look at potentially sort of refreshing your brand.
That's something that people inside the industry talk a lot about, bottle weight. Do you think consumers care at this stage, or is this something that is hedging against the day that they'll care?
I do think consumers in some markets, in some generations, are starting to care. I think there is an acceptance now that weight carries carbon. And so I do believe that there is a shift. I think if you look at, you know, Saverglass, for example, they're producing less and less and less of those really heavy punted bottles simply because there's not the demand for them. That demand is probably being led by retailers who have their own sustainability objectives to meet, but also that has to flow through to consumers and that knowledge base will need to increase. It's interesting that I don't see as much of it happening in some parts of America and actually some parts of Europe, which surprised me given that Europe really, out of all of the sort of, you know, government legislation, seems to be much stronger in Europe than it is anywhere else in the world.
Okay, so going back to design and packaging, when we first spoke, which was 2016, the reason that I knew about you was you'd done this amazing collaboration between Heemskerk, which is a sparkling wine brand, and George Jensen, and created a fantastic stopper for the bottle. And everybody bought loads and loads of sparkling wine because they wanted the stopper. So you told me at the time that collaborations with luxury brands were a trend. Is that still true?
Oh, so true. Oh, my God. I think it's even hotter now than it was back then. I mean, I think we were sort of at the very beginning of this sort of collaboration, I don't know what you call it, like it is just blowing up. So, you know, Penfolds last year did a collaboration with Nego that really talked to culture. It's opened
okay,
up
hang on.
The brand.
I have to stop you. Who is Nego?
So Nego is a really, really fabulous Japanese designer,
okay.
Designer of Human Made, has an absolute cult following with Gen Z And particularly in Asia, but actually globally as well. And so, and he's got a very, very specific style. So when you're looking at Penfolds, which is very old traditional brand, but you know, with huge ambitions to be embedded in culture, it really opened up a whole new audience for them, both geographically and generationally as well. I think things like the recent Dom Perignon and Lady Gaga really reinforces Dom Perignon's place in those clubs, sort of high energy occasions. Verve are always doing amazing collaborations, with the latest one with Yayo Kusama was absolutely gorgeous. I just loved it. You know, Verve is all about escapism and travel, and with Yayoi, it's all about traveling creatively in your mind and escaping to not just a place but an idea. So that was kind of really successful. And then one that we're quite close to is the collaboration between St. Hugo and Daniel Ricciardo with the DR3 range. And that's about bringing, you know, the idea of precision and perfection between those two brands to life.
How does that, play out in practical terms?
Well, what happens is the joy of these collaborations, right, is that you get this sort of merger of two identities, two brands, two personalities, and it ends up being greater than the sum of parts, because you're actually combining two sometimes unexpected, sometimes expected brands that consumers it forces them to reevaluate the other brand that you've bought in, either the wine brand or the fashion brand. So it's a really great way of piggybacking off someone else's reputation, and I'd say both at the same time.
Can you describe to me what it actually is? Is it a collaboration to do with the label, the packaging? What, if for somebody who can't see it, what does the collaboration entail?
So often it is from the ground up. So it's about so I'll talk about Daniel Ricciardo with St. Hugo. So that Daniel has been involved with the creation of DR3 from the very beginning. So he's worked with the winemakers. They've had him at all of the tastings to work out the barrel selection, work out that blend. He's part of the design process. So, you know, he's part of the briefing, he's certainly part of the selection of the branding, and then all of the other
a new wine.
Yeah, and all of the other sort of different kind of aspects of the brand world that come to life through that collaboration.
Okay.
I mean, so with Penfolds and Nigo, they've even done carpets. I mean, it's a rug. It's crazy stuff, but you know, it's that all kind of fits into this.
Oh my god, I have to, while you're talking, I have to Google. So what does the rug look like? Describe it to me.
Well, it's a Grange rug. It's a round rug with Grange in it. It's based off an old Grange poster, I think. And it has been designed by Nigo, and you know, it's part of the Nigo and Penfolds merchandise that has been created.
So I've just looked it up.
Can you see it?
Yeah, it's a round rug. It's got Penfolds and Nigo written on the edge. And it's amazing. I want one. It's a limited edition silk rug. And there's only 25 rugs available globally. Do you have one in your office?
I don't. I wish I did, but I don't.
The design features a silk-dyed purple grape design to mirror that of the wine's gift box. Oh, my God. And how long did it take to put that together?
Well, I have no idea of the specifics of that one, but I do know that they did a limited run of bomber jackets, human-made bomber jackets, the Penfolds Nigo collaboration, and they sold out within half an hour.
You know, putting the logo on the handbag. That's
yeah. Exactly.
Okay, so what other trends are you seeing in packaging design? And we've covered sustainability, so talk through some of the others.
Yeah, Sustainability is pretty key. I think quiet luxury is definitely having its day. So that sort of more minimalist, more kind of understated, quieter version of luxury. So we did a design for Larry Cherubino, who's a winemaker in Western Australia, called On the Fringe. And the label is just super, super confident. It's just all the white label, and it's got a tear at the bottom, and right at the bottom in Larry's handwriting, it just says, "On the fringe is where you find the greatest reward." And that is a quote from him when he was briefing us on this brand, wanting to do, you know, these wines from Pemberton, which is really, really challenging area to grow wines in. That's what he said. And we were like, I love that.
So if you've got a label like that, where is it going to be seen? Because in a dark restaurant, it's going to be hard to be seen. And on a shelf with, you know, 100 other labels, it's not going to jump out. So how do you make sure that something as courageous as that doesn't get lost in the mix?
So it is primarily winery, DGC, and on-premise. But interestingly, because it is devoid of graphics, it is literally just this white label with a tear at the bottom. It's so different that actually it catches your eyes, not because it has all this stuff on it, but because it doesn't. It's just so, so clean and simple, and everything is down the bottom. So it actually forces you as a consumer to lean in to see what is actually written on the bottom of the label. So you're actually playing tricks with how crowded the shelf is, and then how you actually disrupt within that space.
Okay, other trends.
Okay, other trends. Look, we talked about collabs for luxury, but collabs just generally are just taking off everywhere. So in this month alone, or in June alone, we launched Love Dolly, which is a partnership with Dolly Parton for her wines.
Oh, wow.
I know. I mean, talk about brief of the century. I was so excited when I got
that. You buried the lead, as we say in journalism. You should have put that right up front. Did you get to meet Dolly Parton?
No, I didn't get to meet her, which is very sad. But my clients did, and look, it was just such a joyous project. She's been a very big part of my childhood. You know, my dad loved listening to her music, so I was so excited when it launched to be able to send him a photograph.
Well, she's not just any celebrity; she's a very beloved figure for the work that she's done.
Oh my goodness! Like the statistics behind her popularity are incredible. So yeah, amazing. That'll be an amazing collaboration.
Talk me through the design process for something like that, where somebody's got such an outsized footprint.
That was actually really tough, right? Because Dolly has so many aspects to her personality. So, you know, she has the sort of country girl with the gingham, and she has, you know, the sort of sparkles, and then she has this affinity with butterflies. She calls butterflies her symbol. She supports the Butterfly Foundation. She supports all sorts of different foundations that are connected to butterflies, and that's what we ended up choosing. So so whilst we did designs in all of these different aspects for Dolly, the one that she loved and the one that we loved was a sort of butterfly-shaped label. And it has all of these little butterflies on the label that have holographic foil, which we've never used before, but it's like glitzes and shimmers, just like Lot Dolly does. And then she, just in her handwriting, it just has Love Dolly on the label with a little kiss. Oh, it's just so cute. And just so Dolly, right? Like so Dolly. It's just, it was a joy to work on. And then we did all of the key visuals and the photographic shoot with her, and, you know, it was like a dream project.
Oh, what a great one to work on.
I know. And then we've just done Mass, which is Leo Messi's drink. Now that is out of alcohol category, but it's a health drink that he has just launched, and that was pretty exciting, kind of, again, delving into the personality of Messi and what he stands for, and all of the, you know, and his personality and the people that follow him just absolutely love him with good reason. He's just an incredible guy. So trying to bring that professionalism and athleticism onto the pack was really cool. And then we've just done another brand for Snoop called Cali Gold, which is a RTD that's available in the States. Again, just kind of playing on Snoop, but making it different from 19 Crimes. So this one, we've used the bandana that he always wears in concerts. We've actually taken that pattern of the bandana and used that as a sort of graphic treatment or brand treatment for Cali Gold as well.
Okay, so that's a fair few trends. Any more that you want to talk about?
I think there's one, and I'm trying to work out how significant it is, but I think it's going to be more and more significant, and that's a sort of anti-wellness trend.
Oh, I love that. Tell me about that. I hate wellness, bloody... into the wine thing. Tell me about the backlash.
And oh, my goodness, there's been so much wellness. So we're seeing brands like we designed a brand about 2 years ago called Greasy Fingers.
You didn't.
That's so brilliant. Good, right? So the client, who is brilliant, was like, I want to develop a wine that goes with burgers.
Oh, I love that.
Like
great.
Burgers are just, you know, fantastic. So actually it developed, so it's actually just fast food. It's like, you know, fried chicken and whatever, but burgers was the starting place. And so to really get across this kind of, I don't know, approachability of like, it doesn't have to be white tablecloths. You know, you can crack open a bowl of red and have them with your burgers, and grease can drip down your fingers, and that is just living and loving life. And then we did a redesign of layer cake in the States, where we've got like the frosting of the layer cake. So really, you know, as soon as you see it, your mouth starts salivating, thinking how delicious this wine is going to be. So they're not shying away from sugar. They're just going straight into it. So I think there's some really interesting things happening.
Anti-alcohol, if we're going to eventually see, you know, a real backlash against that as
Oh, I can't wait for that to happen.
Like austerity, there's only so much of it you can take, and then, you know, the backlash happens. Talking about non-alcohol and things like that, do you have to design differently for non-alcohol, or are you specifically trying to make it look like alcohol?
It really depends on the brief. So we do both. So a lot of our work, because we're alcohol specialists, comes in from an alcohol lens. So trying to get a brand that's either a de-alcoholized wine or something like a sparkling tea that wants to play in that alcohol space. So a sophisticated adult environment, be dinner, drinks beforehand, etc. Both those categories, we really do look at introducing alcohol cues or wine cues or spirits cues into that brand. We also, because that non-alc area is growing so quickly, we also do other drinks, not a lot, but progressively more and more, like Messi's Mass, like Waters, those kind of things, which are using our insights and our knowledge of how consumers use liquid and have, you know, beverages as part of their repertoire and developing brands that not just play in that alcohol space but do something differently in that non-alc category.
Okay, so final thoughts about where design is going. The wine industry in particular is facing, you know, a drop in consumption. Things are getting much tougher. Budgets are lower than they have been in the past. What do people really need to think about in terms of design and packaging for the more difficult future we're going into?
Well, I think we've got to be really sensible about COGS. So the cost of goods conversation is not going to go away for some time. So being really sensible as design consultants with what we're specifying in terms of bottles, labels, et cetera, will make a big difference to our clients' bottom line. I think it's about, as always, trying to make sure that we are continuing to attract new drinkers into our category, and also recognizing that this is cyclical. You know, that, you know, I remember 10 years ago, everyone was terrified that the millennials were drinking wine, and now they are so drinking wine. And so I do think that, you know, once Gen Z come to an age where they've got more money and they're more sophisticated and their palates have developed, then wine will be a natural transition for them. You know, I think I don't want to just put on rose-coloured glasses, but I do think that there needs to be some optimism as we look at those younger consumers and also the amount of money that they're spending. Whilst they mightn't be spending, the volumes might not be as high, certainly that the amount that they're spending per bottle is way higher than comparative to millennials, Gen X, et cetera.
That's really interesting. All right. Look,
yeah, especially in the US.
I've taken up so much of your time. I've actually got loads more design questions to ask, but I'll have to wait for another day. I want to thank you very, very much for giving me your time and your insights, Rowena.
That's an absolute pleasure, Felicity. So great chatting. And, yeah, I look forward to having another session.
You've been listening to Drinks Insider, the podcast that explores the intersection of beverages and commerce. Now, if you would like a summary of this episode, sign up for the Drinks Insider newsletter, which sends you the takeaways. Just go to drinksinsider.com and add your name. And if there's something you think we should be talking about, drop me a line at felicity@drinksinsider.com. And before you go, please don't forget to rate this podcast. 5 stars are most welcome. Thank you.